තෙරුවන් සරණයි. I have a letter. Another one. Yep. I want to read this to you. Because I think this is a testimony to what we have managed to achieve over the many months. As I always tell you, this is not just one man trying to change the world. I suppose it is one man trying to change your world. But then when you all get together as a community, each and every one of you contribute to that change. And then together, collectively, that's a massive change that one man cannot make. So this is a testimony to that. As you listen to this, I want you to reflect on what your contribution has been to this. And I also want you to look within yourselves and ask yourselves if similar has not happened within yourselves as well. Because I believe if you have been coming along and you have been coming out of your own desire to be here, not because someone's dragged you here, not because of the free sandwich you get at the end. But if you have been coming here because you want to be here, and you feel that there's something pulling at your heartstrings, something tugging at you every Sunday to get you out of bed, and to get you out of your pajamas, and to get you here, then something has happened within you. That something may be very little for some still. For others it may be very profound. For yet others, I think soon enough we will start to see the fruits that will be born on those trees. As slowly but steadily, I am sure you will start to make headway into experiencing what the Sambuddha Sasana truly has to offer to you. So let me read this to you. Swamin Vahansa, I extend my deepest and heartfelt gratitude to you and the entire community at Jetanarama Monastery, as well as the noble Rajagiriyans. Your presence and guidance have been a beacon of light in my life. There was a time when I wandered through life, feeling utterly lost and disconnected. Like I said, I want you all to look within yourselves and see if this does not resonate deeply. Because this cannot be one person's story. Many have walked this path before, and many have experienced similar transformations happen within themselves. This is you. There was a time when I wandered through life feeling utterly lost and disconnected. My mind was a storm of confusion and unrest, and I struggled to find even a semblance of peace within myself. Reflecting on that dark period now, it's hard to fathom how I managed to persevere without any real sense of purpose or direction. Each day felt like an endless struggle, and I often questioned the meaning of my existence. I feel fortunate to have had an impact on this life. This is someone's life. I feel that there was probably a point in whoever this person is, in their life, where it was a very fine balance between sanity and maybe insanity. Perhaps it was the Dhamma that changed it all for them. We have heard plenty of stories, ladies and gentlemen, as to how people are driven to the end of their tether, and many a time we receive letters informing us of imminent end to life. I'm not suggesting that this is where they would have gone, but what I'm saying is, this is a testimony to the transformations that have happened in many people's lives. And I also want you to think about what contribution you have made to make this a reality. Each day felt like an endless struggle, and I often questioned the meaning of my existence. I was adrift, yearning for something more, something that could fill the void within me. It was during this time of despair that I encountered the noble community at Rajagiriya. See, they found you first before they found me. So I can't take credit for all of this. It was at this time they found whom? Swaminanze? No, the noble community at Rajagiriya. The wisdom and compassion I have found here, was like a lifeline, pulling me from the depths of my own suffering. I don't know what karmic deeds from my past lives have blessed me with this incredible opportunity, but I am eternally grateful for it. My gratitude for this gift is profound and extends beyond what words can adequately express. I firmly believe that this noble community has journeyed through samsara together, lifetime after lifetime. They feel a very special bond with you. And that is what they have tried to capture in a few words in this letter. More so than an expression of gratitude towards the Swamin Mohan says, I feel this is a gratitude that has been extended to the community that is you. It is a comforting thought to know that we have all been companions on this long and winding journey, supporting and uplifting one another through the ages. The bonds that we share are not merely of this lifetime, but are woven through the fabric of countless lifetimes. This realization fills me with awe and reverence for the journey we are all on and for the incredible minds who accompany me on this path. Theruvan Sarnai. That is a token of gratitude extended by someone amongst you to all of you. And that is why I mean it, ladies and gentlemen, when I say this. The Sangha is not just the robe bearers, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas. This is the fourfold community that make up the Sangha. Without you, this could not have been achieved. If it weren't for your smiles, if it weren't for your welcome, if it weren't for your invitation, if it weren't for you making people feel homely when they come here, and for extending your heartfelt welcome to them. This would not have been possible. I have seen places where monks, nuns, and so forth, they preach the Dhamma. But hardly, or rather rarely, have I seen communities get together for the purpose of salvation, where it is a real sense of one for all and all for one. I feel that that is here with this community. Each and every one of you standing strong for everyone, and all of you standing strong for one. If there's anyone among us, if there's anyone here who's going through a hard time, hardship, would you not be willing to put your hand up and spend a few minutes with them? Wouldn't you? If anyone amongst you would say, Swaminhansa, I'm really going through a tough time. The waters are really rough. Life has taken a bad turn. I don't know what to do. Things are getting really out of hand and I need help. And if I feel that, a little chat with one of you would make all the difference for them. Is there anyone among you who would say, no, Swaminhansa, I don't have the time for that? Would you? Of course not. That is the community that the Dhamma has been able to create. And you're all part of that. Each of you is a thread that has woven this fabric. And it is so strong. This is the fabric that will protect you, that will cover you, that will guide you. In that, I want you to see a robe. It's a virtual robe. As a community, as you come together, each of you an individual thread, but as you weave together, there is a robe. That is the chivara. This is the kind of community that will encourage and inspire men and women to take the next step, to go forth into the sasana. Because before anything, ladies and gentlemen, one must feel love and compassion and a sense of homeliness. Otherwise, you won't enter the sasana without that. You know, after all, Nibbana will happen eventually, but until then, you have to be happy, right? And if you can't find your heart wherever you are, then that cannot be home. So if I can speak on behalf of the many people who have come through our gates over the years, initially they came looking for Nibbana, but they stayed because they found home there. And then once they found home there, then from then on, they started working on their salvation. That's how it always works, and that's how it is supposed to work. We are not an academy. We are not an academy where we just dispense Nibbana. It's not a counter. Next. What do you want? Paracetamol? Right. It's not a counter where we dispense Nibbana. Nibbana cannot be dispensed in that manner. Nibbana is something that is born within you. It is a product of many a causes. The Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, together, collectively, they give rise to Nibbana. I am who I am, ladies and gentlemen, because of the community that I am in. Yes, of course, the Buddha was there as the great teacher. It is to whom we always make our reverence. It is to whom we bring our palms together in veneration. Always, yes. It is he who strode this path alone, with no teacher, with no one to guide him. The Buddha is the only one who can tread this path without a community. Because there is no community to guide him. There's no community to find his faults, to show them, point them out to him. He has to do it all by himself. And that is why it takes so long. The creation of a Buddha doesn't happen overnight. You know this, right? 4 incalculable eons is how long our Bodhisattva took to attain to Buddhahood. They're called incalculable eons because you cannot give it, you cannot represent it with a number. That's how long it is. It is not 100 years. You can count 100 years. It is not 1,000 years. It's not 1,000,000 years because even 1,000,000 can be counted. It is not 1 billion or 1 trillion years. It's not 1 zillion years. Imagine a container 16 miles long, 16 miles wide, 16 miles high. And in this box you fill this with mustard seeds. And then you take one out every 100 years. The time it takes to empty that box is still shorter than the period of a yawn. And that's not even an incalculable yawn. There are different types of yawns. That's just one yawn. Many, many, many of those go into making an incalculable yawn. Four incalculable eons is how long it takes a Bodhisattva to become a Buddha, because, you know, that is the price he pays for not having a community. Simple as that. It's the price a Bodhisattva has to pay for not having the community, for not having the Sangha. Because without the Bodhisattva, there is no Buddha. Without the Buddha, there is no Sangha. Because what is the Sangha after all? A community that has listened to, understood the Dhamma. So without the Dhamma, or without the Buddha, there is no Dhamma. Without the Dhamma, there is no Sangha. But that's the price the Bodhisattva has to pay. You and I, we don't have to pay that price. You and I, we don't have to pay that price because we have the what? We have the Sangha. We have noble association, which is what the Buddha did not have. Therefore, he had to discover this all by himself. So, time and time again, I'm reminded when I read these letters how fortunate I have been to receive noble companionship. Remember on the 50th anniversary of these sermons, not the 50th anniversary, but rather on the 50th sermon, you handed a book in which you most lovingly wrote various letters of appreciation and so on. And in that book, as I read them, I reflected on how lucky and fortunate I have been to be in the midst of this community. Like-minded individuals who keep pulling and pushing each other on the path of Nibbana. Sometimes what it takes is a push. Sometimes what it takes is a pull. Sometimes it just takes a nudge. Just a few words of encouragement. You can do it. Let's go together. I'll give you a lift. What are you doing next Sunday? Surely you can rearrange that engagement for a sermon. If you're going, I'll come with you. Sometimes, you know, it's just a few words. A little push here, a little pull there, a little nudge here, a little elbowing there, you know. Whatever it takes. All that done with kindness and loving kindness and compassion. And that is that community that has driven you all this while. So, once again, this is a testimony. This is a salutation to your contribution. I don't take credit for this. This is yours. You deserve credit for this. You deserve this praise. You deserve this honor. I want you to rejoice in this. And I want you to rejoice in this because in these words, as you listen to them, you will have acquired merits. If you are happy to listen to me read this, then that would have earned you merits. May those merits help you and guide you further to take another step on this journey to your own salvation. Because what we have given to others is what we get back, ladies and gentlemen. That's always how it is. That's always how it is. So you have made this happen for someone. And this is only one person amongst many. So therefore, if this has happened for one person, I'm sure it has happened for hundreds. Similar has happened for many, and you have all been behind that story. I want now you to be part of that story. Be part of this journey. Let the collective effort guide you. Let it inspire you. May it take you further. And on this path, noble association is what we need. It is what we have today, which we will not have forever. So whilst we have it, we have to make sure that we make use of it. Because once noble association has come to an end, once that has expired, then that will be the end of it all. And then we have to wait for the next bodhisattva. We are assured that there will be another Buddha in this eon. That is what makes us a Bhadrakalpa. One more Buddha to come in this eon. And after that, we don't know how long it's going to be until the next Buddha's arrival. But then, who knows where you will be when that Buddha comes into this world? I'm not willing to take that gamble. I don't know if you feel so adventurous, if you feel so brave to be so willing to hang around till the next Buddha comes along, because let's be honest, the next Buddha is going to come and preach the same thing. He's not going to put it or dress it up any differently. His teaching will be the same. Because all Buddhas do is they don't invent different things, they just come and discover lost land. The land of Nibbana, the land of paradise, it is lost, covered in the sands of time. What they do is they just come and discover what was once discovered, they rediscover. And the next Buddha comes and rediscovers. And the following Buddha, he rediscovers. That's what happens. And when that land is found, then we can all go and inhabit that land for a while. Those who are inhabitants, they get their job done and they exit samsara. Those who don't, well, they have to wait for the next boat. How long have you been waiting? Our bodhisattva passed 512,027 Buddhas. I'll say that again. Our bodhisattva, he passed 512,000. Not 512, 512,000. That's 5 lakhs and 12,000 plus another 27. It's not like a Buddha comes every weekend. And in that period, there have been many eons without Buddhas. Many eons without Buddhas. Such was the time it took our Bodhisattva, who had profound wisdom. His strength was his wisdom. There are other Bodhisattvas who are stronger in their willpower. There are others who are stronger in their faith. But our Bodhisattva, he's a very special one. That's why it took him only such a short period of time. Those who have great willpower but not such wisdom, it takes them 8 incalculable eons. Not 4, but 8. Those who have a lot of faith but not so much willpower or not so much wisdom, it takes them 12. Not years, incalculable eons. So there were plenty of those Buddhas interspersed in this journey that our Bodhisattva took. So just imagine how long that period of time might have been. And today we are, our Buddha has also passed into Parinibbana, and you and I, we are still here discussing about his great feats and how he managed to become a Buddha and how he managed to pass all those Bodhisattvas. We talk about the adventures of our Bodhisattvas, and yet you and I, we are still here. It's a pity, isn't it? So that is why I keep encouraging you all the time. Let's not hang around to talk about how great the Maitri Bodhisattva is. And how the mighty Buddha was such a great human being, and how he also walked the surface of this earth and was such a blessing to humanity. Let's not hang around to talk about him. Because we now have the opportunity in our Bodhisattva, in our Buddha's time, to attain Nibbana. So it's tantamount to attaining Nibbana, your practice that you put towards that. It is essential that you work towards that. Not on my behalf, but on yours. So, that's why we are here. That's why we are here, to learn the Dhamma, so that we can use it on our practice and to help us achieve what we were born as human beings to achieve. Let's bring our palms together then. In veneration of the great master, our great teacher, the Buddha who sacrificed himself, who sacrificed life and limb, and many long years on our behalf, so that all sentient beings could attain to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
You're looking at me like I have all the answers. It's not my task to give you all the answers. So don't look at me like that. Those who have the problem, they are the ones who have the answers. It's not like you have the problem and I have the answers. If you have the problem, you also have the answer. You're just blind to the answer, that's all. You have the answer. If you took a bit of string and tied a knot in it, now you have a problem. Where is the answer? To look for the answer, where do you look? Somewhere else? Then? It's in the string, isn't it? If you want to undo the knot, right, you take the string, you inspect it. You bring it closer to your eyes and you look at it. You really study the problem. In your study of the problem, the answer becomes obvious. So it's not like the problem is somewhere and the answer is somewhere else. So the problem is with you, then why look at me? I don't have the answers. You should look within yourselves. There is no problem really than not seeing the answer itself. That is the problem. You see, when the Buddha discovered the truth and he proclaimed the truth under that Bodhi tree, actually not under the Bodhi tree at that time, when he gave his first discourse, to the five ascetics. And he said, today I proclaim the truths, the four noble truths. It is said that at the end of this discourse, one individual in the audience, there were five of them, one of them attained the state of stream enterer. So he entered the state of stream enterer, meaning he saw the truth. He became a sotapanna. It was only the truth that the Buddha uttered. The Buddha uttered the truth. He said, idam dukkham. පුබ්බේ අනනුසුතේසු ධම්මේසු චක්කං උදපාදී, ඥානං උදපාදී, විද්‍යා උදපාදී, ආලෝකෝ උදපාදී. This is the truth. This is the first noble truth. And I have seen it. I have realized it. I have witnessed it. And that's what he said. Someone in the audience listens to this and he understands the same truth. When he understands the truth, that is all that was needed for him to become a stream enterer. Meaning, the point I'm trying to get across to you is, the problem is simply that you don't see the truth. That is the problem. There is no other problem. There is no additional problem to not seeing the truth. Does that make sense? There is no additional problem to not seeing the truth. Not seeing the truth is the problem. Because here's what happens when you don't see the truth. Everything else you see is a lie. Because there can only be one truth. If there's one truth, then everything else is a what? Is a lie. Is a falsehood. If one is true, then everything else is false. So, your problem is not that you see 100 false. 100 things false or 100 falsehoods. The problem is not seeing just one truth. That's all you have to do. Just see one truth. And when you have seen that one single individual truth, then it is not incumbent on me to teach you that everything else is a falsehood. You don't need that. Once you have seen the truth, everything else becomes obvious to you are falsehoods. So all we have to do, ladies and gentlemen, is just see the truth. Now, as simple as that might sound, you might think, well, yes, we get that Swaminhansa, so what do we have to do for that? You just have to see the truth. That's all you have to do. Just see the truth. The truth is staring at you in the face. It's there. You know, this is why a Buddha does not have to invent the truth. Because it has always been staring at him in his face. It's always been there. Buddhist philosophy is simply a discovery. It is not an invention. The Buddha discovered the truths. He discovered the truth. He realized the truth and he said, in this world, there are no sentient beings as you would like to think, but what they are is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. There's mind and there's matter. That's what there is. So why do you call each other husbands and wives when all there is mind and matter? Why do you call each other brothers and sisters when all there is mind and matter? Why do you call yourselves Sri Lankans, Indians, Pakistanis when all there is mind and matter? Why do you call yourselves Buddhists and others call themselves Christians, others call themselves Muslims when all there is mind and matter? If all there is mind and matter, are we so different from each other? Isn't there more about us that unites us and makes us all the same than there is whatever divides us? You know, the only thing that divides us is ignorance. That is the only thing that divides us, ignorance. I hope you understand the profoundness of these words. The only thing that divides us is ignorance. Whenever you think to yourself, right from the very basics, right? Whenever you think to yourself, whatever your identity is, you have an identity card, you have a passport, right? On there you have your credentials. This is my identity, this is who I am, this is where I'm from, this is my first name, these are my surnames, my given names, and so on, right? When you look at that piece of document, that piece of paper, and you look at it yourself and think, that's me. That's not me, that's ignorance. When you look at the person next to you and you feel that this is me and that's another person, we are identity, we are individuals, right? That's not another individual, that's just ignorance, because outside, out there is not another individual, that's just mind and matter. So within you, what is there? Mind and matter. So whenever you sense that this is me and over there is another person, on to my right is another person, in front of me is another person and behind me is there probably another one, whenever you sense that, ladies and gentlemen, that is not another person who's there, left, right, forward or behind. That's just ignorance. And where is ignorance? Either side of you? In front of you or behind you? Where's ignorance? Within you. That's all there is. So why did you get married? Because you were? I think that you will agree. That's why sometimes you catch yourself saying, if I had known better, if only I had taken my mother's advice. But I mean this in another sense. You got married because you looked at another person and you thought, there is another person. But all there was is mind and matter. You are attracted not to the other person, you are attracted to a creation within your own mind. That's the irony of this. You know, you never got married, ladies and gentlemen, to who you thought there was. You brought home another package of mind and matter. But in your mind you were bringing home, that's what you thought, you were bringing home, you thought another individual, but actually what you brought home was another package of mind and matter, that's all. It was just another collection. Just another panchaskanda. If you'd realized this at that point, at that time, you wouldn't have done that. Because you yourself is just mind and matter. Why do you need another lot of mind and matter? What's that going to add to your life? How does that make your life any richer? You know, there's one heap, on top of that you heap another. Now how many heaps are there? Still? One. Picture this in your mind. You have a heap of sand, onto which you put even more sand. Now how many heaps do you have? You still have one. That's all there is at home. When you were alone, you were just mind and matter. Then you brought someone home. Now there is you and another person. What's actually there? Still more mind and matter. That's all. So what was that whole task for? What have you achieved? What have you accomplished? Nothing really. But inside you, you think, now I'm a family. Now we are a couple. Now I'm in a relationship. There is no such thing called a relationship besides what your own thing. It is your own ignorance which makes you think that you're in a relationship. You are not in one. You think you are in one. That's why oftentimes you are fooled. That's how people trick you. There are times when you think you are in a relationship with someone, but they don't think the same. You think you are in a relationship with someone, but they don't think the same. They think they're in a relationship with someone else. So where's the relationship then? This is you. This is the person you're attracted to. This is the person they are attracted to. Person 1 and person 2. This is you, the person you are attracted to, the person they are attracted to. Okay? So tell me, where's the relationship? You think this is a relationship. You actually feel that I have a relationship. That you give them names, don't you? I have a really strong relationship. You almost feel like there's something that exists between the two of you. You feel like there's something that ties the two of us together. Remember when you were on the Porua? Like they kept your little fingers together. Right? And they tied the string around it. And then you exchange rings. Yeah? When you exchange those rings, and sometimes these rings are inscribed with the other person's initials and so on. Remember those days? No, I didn't read them off a book. Been there, done that. I've worn the t-shirt. Now I know what it feels like. So you thought you had a relationship. You thought that actually there's a relationship that exists between the two of us. That's why when a third person tries to enter, you say, hey, excuse me, she's mine. She's taken. Hello, she's mine. So somehow he's supposed to know that. He or she is supposed to know that you have this something special between them. It's like you feel like there's kind of some kind of rope or something that ties the two of you together. There's a bond, like a physical bond. You feel like there's a physical bond between the two of you. No such thing exists, ladies and gentlemen. So when I draw this relationship between the two of them, if I do it like this, what's wrong about this? If this arrow, this double-headed arrow, is supposed to represent the relationship that these two people have, what's wrong about this diagram? Have a think. This arrow, this double-headed arrow, is supposed to represent the relationship that these two people have with each other. Okay? Once again, this is you. This is the other person. You have a relationship with them. This arrow is supposed to represent that relationship that you have with the other person. What's wrong about this relationship? What's wrong about this diagram? It is a misrepresentation of what a relationship is actually all about. It is a complete misrepresentation. Would you like me to correct it? That's what it is. Nothing exists between the two of them. Nothing. Not virtually nothing, literally nothing. The fact that this person is my whoever is only in the perception of this individual. It's purely perceptional. 100%. That's why if they lost their memory, then what happens to the relationship? That's gone with it. So if that relationship is dependent on them remembering that this person is my whoever, let's say spouse, if it's dependent on this person remembering that this is my spouse, then how strong is that bond? As strong as their memory in that case. See, that's why people cheat on you. Because these relationships, they are never with you. Don't fall into that trap. When someone comes up to you and says, I love you, you almost feel like now they give you love. It's like they have extended their love to you. It's like they radiate love and now somehow you are in that force field of love. That's how you feel. Do you remember falling in love? No? Yes, you fell into it. That's true. See? You dug it and you fell into it. That's how you fall in love. But when you had that experience for the first time, if you remember, falling in love, yet you almost felt like that person, the other person to whom you're attracted, the other person to whom you feel this sense of affection, is actually giving you something. Did you not honestly feel that? Like they were extending something to you. Like, here, here's my love. And so therefore, when they gave you a bunch of flowers, maybe they gave you some chocolates or maybe some other gift, you felt like that was another extension of their love. And remember asking them, will you always love me? Will you? Will you always love me? And when you were in their embrace, you felt like that was a show of affection. You felt like when they touched you, they were somehow sending love. Think about this. Remember when they caressed you? Petted you? Stroked your head? Or held your hand? Isn't that why you feel excited when your loved one holds your hand? You almost feel like the love that arises in their heart, and you think that's where it arises, somewhere here, when it has nothing to do with love, really, right? Because it's in the mind, right? So you think it's in the heart somewhere. So when you do a heart transplant, what happens? Then it will come with the baggage. So everyone they were in love with, now you also have love towards them. That's not how it works. Science has proven to you that love is not in the heart. That's the very reason a heart transplant still works, and when they regain consciousness after their surgery, they are still going, they're back to loving the same people that they loved before they went into the operation theater. So it's not in the heart. But somehow when you hold someone's hand, you feel like there's love that emanates from the heart and it flows through their bones and their blood and their vessels, and somehow it goes through their fingers and then through to yours. That's why you want to interlock your fingers, right? Huh? Because through these fingers, love flows, doesn't it? That's what I'm asking you. How do you represent love? This way? Sometimes you feel like it's only like this. Yeah? Sometimes you feel that it's like that. I love you, but you don't love me, you know. What happens when this happens? When you feel it's like this, then it becomes a nuisance. Yes? You don't love them, but they say they love you, and then they keep loving after you, and they become a stalker. But you want this. Mutual love. But let's open our eyes to the truth. No such thing exists. There is not a love that flows through you to another person, ladies and gentlemen. Love does not work that way, because love is an emotion. An emotion only lives in the world of perceptions. It's like fear. Can you transfer your fear to someone else? I mean, if you can transfer love from one person to the other, then you must also be able to transfer what? Fear. What about sorrow? You should be able to transfer sorrow as well, right? So, someone's lost their loved ones. Like you go to the funeral, and someone's grieving over their mother's death. Now, if you can transfer love in that manner, you should also be able to transfer what? Grief in that manner. So you should go to the funeral and say, whatever you do, don't touch me. Why? Because if they touch you, what would happen? Then grief would flow through their body to you. You know it doesn't work like that. But why do we feel that when we love each other, we have to hold our hands because that is the way they transfer their love to me? I mean, you can transfer blood, but you can't transfer love. this is the circle of, this is the world within which love exists, fear exists, grief exists, sorrow exists, jealousy exists, lust exists, desire exists. All of these things exist in this little world. You are an island. Trust me. You are an island. You have never given love to anyone, and you have never received love from anyone either. But when your little one cries and looks up to you and goes, "Ah, Amma," you feel like now you have to hold your child so that you can transfer that love to the child. No, it's not true. Because love is not something you can transfer. It's an emotion that has to be born within the mind. This love as you speak of is an emotion that the mind feels when it feels inadequate. I don't know why I feel like dissecting love on the dissecting table today, but that's the topic that's come from how? Let's talk about it. It's a feeling that you feel within yourself when you feel inadequate. The love that you speak of. I'm not talking about noble love. I'm talking about the love that you feel that one person has to give to the other. That love you feel when you have a sense of inadequacy within yourself. I'll explain to you why I say that. When you feel like you love another person, like take whatever example comes to mind right now. Like whoever you love in this way. I don't mean noble love, by the way. That is loving kindness. That's a different kind of love. Noble love is different. That noble love, even an arahant has. I'm not talking about that. Because an arahant does not feel a sense of inadequacy. They are complete. So let me explain to you why I say that love, this kind of sentimental love, the love that we expect from other people, the love that we feel that our husbands and wives should show us, the love that we feel like our brothers and sisters should show us, the love that we feel like our family should show us. Now at the end of this talk, I'll probably say, you know, be a good mother, be a good father, be a good brother and a sister and a good husband and a wife, right? And show people your love. Of course, I'll say that. I mean it in a different sense. This worldly love, I have no time or place for it. Because it is a sense of inadequacy that arises within you. That's why that love you can't give to everyone. Think about this. The kind of worldly love, or what I like to say, dirty love, it's not pure. That love is not pure. Because pure love, it matters not who the other person is on the other end. That's pure love. Whether saint or sinner, you can love them equally. Pure love. But I call this dirty love because it is all dependent on what you want out of that relationship. That's why your love today will change tomorrow. That's why relationships break. People that you love today, to the moon and back. Sometimes, you know, you say, you know, till death do us part. Remember those words with which you promised the other person, till death do us part. And then you part, and you're still fine. And then you just go and find the next one. And then you say it again, what? Till death do us part. That's why I say that kind of love, dirty love, dirty love, it's tainted. It's tainted with selfishness. It's a feeling of, here's what I want from the other person, and if I get that, I feel good. That love, is an expression of that emotion. You feel that love when you sense you get what you want from the other person. It's, in other words, really a sense of pleasure that arises in your mind. That's why you don't experience that when the other person does not give you what you want from them. That's why those love relationships sometimes turn into hate relationships. Sometimes people say that, right? We have a love-hate relationship. That's why two lovers today can go on to become worst enemies. I've seen people who were in very loving marriage relationships and then something happened. Right? Maybe it was the in-laws, maybe it was something else, maybe this person came along and then this person no longer wanted to be in this relationship. So when I say this person came along and this person no longer wanted to be in this relationship, what do you think happened here? This broke down? You think this broke down? No, because no such thing existed. All that happened was within them there was a sense of love. This is an emotion. So therefore, now what happened? You think a new arrow was formed like this? No. Nothing, no such thing happened. All they realized was, what I like, it's not this person that's going to give me, this person is. Love is very selfish. Therefore, where there is no self, there is no love. What kind of love am I talking about again? Dirty love. Dirty love is selfish. Therefore, where there is no self, there is no selfishness. Therefore, there is no dirty love. All there is pure love. But this word love, it has many connotations. So therefore, even when I say an arahatun nohanse has love, I don't know if everyone understands me in the way that I mean it. Because people have known love in a very contorted, very distorted way. We human beings were not meant to love each other in that way. Because you know what? When God created man, He created him in His spitting image. That's what the Holy Bible says. And He created him complete. There were no inadequacies. Complete. No inadequacies. But somewhere down the line, they ate the forbidden fruit. And then what happened? Inadequacy. Adam and Eve lived together happily. No problem. They didn't feel like they had to love each other. Not this way. Because they were complete. They didn't have a sense of inadequacy. But the moment they took a bite of that apple, the first thing they did was they covered themselves up. They covered up what became all of a sudden their private parts. What part of you is private? I want you to start thinking outside conventional norms, okay? Because while we are here, we are at university. Okay, this is the University of Nibbana. Right? So while you're here, I'll encourage you to think outside societal norms, outside conventional norms, but as you step outside these doors, you go back to your old lives. Please. Okay? When you leave this room, there are private parts which you have to keep private. Right? But after you come in through this gate, through these doors and sit yourselves down, then I'll start questioning you in ways you may never have been questioned before. Ways in which your most fundamental principles, things that you thought were the basics, the fundamentals, the foundations of your existence will be questioned. Because I'm trying to prove that you are nobody. How can there be a private part of a nobody? What's so private about a private part? What makes it private? So the rest of it is public, is it? Just think about it. Why are some parts of our bodies special in some way? I hope this is two adults speaking to each other, right? We are having a mature conversation. Why are some parts of your body special in some way? What makes them special? Think about it. When you touch, your wrist, right, or your hand, that's a sensation, isn't it? That's all it is. There are touch receptors here, there are pressure receptors here, there are heat sensors here, and so on. And when you touch this, there's a stimulus. It carries a signal. It carries a signal to your mind through your brain, and then you perceive that the touch has happened. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, that process. What about when you touch up here? Same thing happens. Here, elbow, shoulder, chest, keep going. Now we enter forbidden territory. How? I mean, what changed? It's all in the mind. This is all to do with the views that people have taken on. These are the views that people have been indoctrinated with. But once again, let me be the first to say that when you're out in society, you have to abide by societal norms, right? So we cover ourselves up because out there are people who believe that there are some parts in your body which ignite the fire of lust within them. Out of compassion, you have to dress appropriately. We need to dress up, yes, so that we can cover ourselves from the elements. Otherwise, the heat gets you, the cold gets you. Natural forces, they get you. So this is a barrier that you put, a shield of sorts to protect yourselves. But my question is, what is it that is about you? What part of your body is private? What makes it private? What makes it special? Why is that part treated differently? If all there is skin, if all there is under the skin muscle, and if all there is bones and blood, right? And the things that make them were the very things that made this as well, the food that you ate, that's all. What makes those parts special? And then I have another question to ask you then, why is it that when you see certain parts, particularly of a body that you believe is of the opposite gender, some strange, funny feelings arise within you? Feelings that you don't feel when you see this or a thumb. Just imagine if people had such feelings when they saw a person's thumb, then you'd have to have something to cover this up as well, wouldn't you? Think about it. In our bodies, we have organs to serve various purposes. Our hands, our arms, it enables us to touch things, carry things, lift things, move things. That's what these things help us do. Our chest helps us breathe, keeps ourselves upright. A mother has a breast so that she can feed her child. That's what it's there for. But how come it has become something else? Why is it that when you see it, some funny feelings arise within you? But do you remember when you were a child, you fed on your mother and no such thing happened? But how come today, those images, you have a different class of websites that glorify that and somehow say, you know, these are special parts of a body, and to see them naked, then you have those websites, and they're called pornography. How did that become pornography? If looking at those organs is pornography, then what's the first thing you show a child when it's born? You don't show a child Tom and Jerry, you show it pornography. Mothers? Yes? I mean, what is it about that part of the body that makes it obscene? What is it that makes it private? What's so private about it? It's just a part of the body. But it's what people have put into your minds. I remember when I was young, and as I started growing up, right, and exposed to society, classmates, friends, they'd come and talk about these things. You'll all have had similar experiences. Media was partly responsible, but friends did most of it. So-called friends. Because, well, you know, they were none the wiser. They'd learned it from their friends and so on. And how somehow they came and represented certain parts of the body as somehow very special. Somehow they had more, I don't know, something about them that the other parts of the body didn't have. So therefore they had to be covered up. And to get a glimpse of something like that was like winning the lottery. That was the picture that was painted in our minds. Growing up, this happened for all of us. And so the more you covered things up, then the more the curious mind wishes to find out what it is. And today, you know, exposing those parts of the body, for some they see it as fashion. I don't know why it is fashion, honestly. For others it is obscene. I don't know why it is obscene either. For others it is offensive. I don't know why. How is that offensive? How is that porn? How is that obscene? I don't know. I don't understand that. I mean, I understand it. I understand, I'm a man of the world, I understand what they mean, but I don't get why. It's flawed thinking. It's weird. It's corrupted thinking. The problem is in the thinking. See, these feelings like lust, it's not something that someone can excite within you. No one has the power to ignite the feeling of lust within you. They don't. It arises within you. It's not something that can be given to you from the outside. It has to arise within. So if it's something that has to arise within, then it's not in the part of the body, is it? Think about it. If you are thirsty and I have water, I give you water, you drink water. Okay? I have given you water. Fair enough. If you want more water, I have to give you more water. Fair enough. So I have given it to you, meaning something external has done that for you. But lust is not something that comes from the outside. It's not something that someone can give you. If it's not something that someone can give you, then it cannot be a part of another person's body, can it? It has to arise within you. If it has to arise within you, then it's not something that can come from the outside. So why do you think that it's something that comes from the outside? So I'm questioning the things that you look at. I'm questioning. I'm asking you to question your behaviors. I'm prompting you to question your habits. More so than anything, I'm appealing to you that you don't insult your intelligence. Because you are. If you look at a picture or a video or something of a naked person and it ignites feelings like lust within you, you're insulting your intelligence. You're insulting your wisdom. At least, ladies and gentlemen, you must understand that no such thing can come to you from the outside. Lust is not something that someone else can catch it. No one can do that. It has to be born within. It is born within because of ignorance. The ignorance that an outside world object can issue or offer lust to you, that ignorance is what creates ignorance within your mind. The same goes for love. These are the things young people should be taught in primary school. So that they don't fall victim. How many young people do you think waste their time in front of a computer watching things that are going to be of no value to them at all, and things that just keep corrupting their minds and just keeps pushing them down a rabbit hole from darkness to darkness? Because once the fire ignites, it's like a wildfire. It just keeps on spreading and it overwhelms you. It engulfs you. It completely consumes you. There may be some in the audience who have such experiences. My offer to you is the Dhamma. The Dhamma is nothing other than the truth. That is why I'm laying the truth out for you, nothing more. All I'm trying to do here is to show you that some of the emotions that you sense are senseless. They're meaningless. They're not based in wisdom. They're not based in the truth. They're not based in any solid foundation. You are simply a victim of ignorance. That's all. Who wishes to be a victim of ignorance? Then all I ask you to do is open your eyes to the truth. Nothing more we need to do here. Just see the truth. That's why I'm laying down these emotions on the dissecting table, cutting them, slicing them, dicing them to show you what they really are. When you realize what fear really is, you will stop sensing it. When you realize what dirty love really is, you'll stop sensing it. When you realize what lust really is, you'll stop feeling it. What does that tell you about lust? It lives, it thrives in the dark. That's why when people have such feelings, such thoughts, they lock themselves in a dark room. Close the windows, draw the curtains, lock the doors, right? Because it's not something that goes hand in hand with light. It's not something that is complementary with wisdom, with intelligence. What is true about lust is the environment that you create when you have such emotions. Sometimes you may have walked in to your child's bedroom. But when these things happen, parents, if you ever find your children, do realize that they are simply victims of ignorance. So if they are victims of ignorance, it is not your job to hit them, beat them, shout at them, kick them out of the house. Then who's the other bigger victim of ignorance? The parents. Because if you don't understand that your child is simply a victim of ignorance, you are also a victim of ignorance. Because you are ignorant of the fact that they are victims of ignorance, which makes you also ignorant. I mean, this is a grave concern for parents, I understand that. And nowadays, with mobile devices in their hands and in their pockets all the time, 24/7, now you can't stop them. Because those days, you used to be able to walk into their rooms and watch what they have on their computers. But now their computers, they travel with them. So you can't always keep an eye out for them. You can't always be aware as to what they do. They're going in and out. You can't. In this world, you can't always keep your surveillance. Yes, they'll have apps for such things. Just for the parent to track their child's internet browsing history and so on. But please do remember that your children are always smarter than you. Please come to terms with that. They'll always outsmart you. Because technology is meant to do that. Technology will only thrive if the younger population always outsmart the older population, so it will always be more sophisticated. That's always how it works. Therefore, there is no other refuge, there is no other solution than simply showing them the truth. That is why it is imperative that parents consider it their duty, their responsibility to teach their children the truth, because you can't keep them from using a mobile phone. Can you? Honestly. Do you remember when the COVID pandemic came? Right? Young children, young people who had never used the internet before, who had never used computers or a mobile device before, had to be given a computer. There might have been parents who are here today. Back then, you thought to yourself, not until he's 16, not until he's 17, not until he's 18 am I going to give him a mobile phone. But then COVID came. Because the schools had to continue teaching. Yeah? So, what did parents have to do? They had to give their children some kind of device. And then the parents had to go to work. They couldn't stay at home to watch the child do what they were going to do. How many parents know about firewalls? It's not a wall on fire. But ask your child, they know. Because they learn about these things. When you were at school, you learned about different kind of things. Not these things. You didn't learn about firewalls. Therefore, you can't outsmart your children. They're always one step ahead of you. That I promise you. They're always one step ahead of you. Because they always keep abreast with technology. What's out there? What's going on? They talk to their friends. So you can't outsmart them. Therefore, the only thing that you can do for them is to open their eyes to the truth. That you can make it mandatory for them. Just as they have to take a shower every evening before they go to bed, they have to learn the Dhamma. That you can make mandatory. If you can't beat them, help them. Help them understand what lust is. Don't forbid them from feeling lust. Help them understand what lust is. Because you only feel lust For as long as you are ignorant of what lust is. So teach them what lust is. See, actually what I'm asking you to do is to take these topics, which you've always thought, you know, these were not things that I as a parent should discuss with my children. Right? Conventionally, that is what how we always managed. But we have moved on now. Right? We live in a global world. If you can't talk about these things with your children, then take them to someone who can. Not to their mates at school. Take them to someone who can teach these things responsibly. Bring them to the Mahasangha. We will teach your child what lust is. When the child understands that lust is nothing other than them sacrificing their happiness on the altar, they will not do that anymore. When a child understands that pornography and watching it and the fire that ignites within is never something, this feeling of joy or that whatever, exhilaration, that feeling that they get is not something that the video or the image or any naked body can ever give him. It's something that is born within. When the child understands that, you know, they're only ignorant. They're not stupid. They're not stupid. They're just ignorant. If they're stupid, you can't fix them. But if they're ignorant, you can teach them. You teach them math, don't you? You teach them science. You teach them geography. You teach them how to cross the street. You teach them how to count money. You teach them how to do a job. How to tie their shoelaces. Why don't you teach them what lust is? You know, you teach them things that they will be using after they graduate from university. But lust, when does that strike? At age 5. That's the going age these days. When you come to a monastery, you've seen, right, little bhattas, our noble hearts, little children. Right? We take children from 5 years, 6, minimum age 6. 6 upwards. You know, children as young as 6, 7, they come to us and they talk about things that they would never dream of speaking with you because you think your child is so naive. You think your children don't know these things. Oh, they could teach you. Just because you don't talk about these things with your children doesn't mean they don't know. Remember, you have a TV at home. Those days when mothers used to feed their children, they used to sing to them folk songs, nursery rhymes. Like when we were younger, our parents were younger, our grandparents used to sing them Budugunugi. That's what they used to do. But these days, mothers don't know any of these things. So when they feed the child, if the child is becoming a little bit restless, what they do is give them what? The smartphone. Hey Buddha, Angry Pigs. Play that. That's what the child knows. So from age 3, 4, 5, the child is now familiar with technology. It's only a matter of time because the device that you're giving the child, putting in his hand, is sharper than a knife. It's sharper than a knife. A knife will only cut once. The child learns a lesson. Don't they? When a child is cut once, the child learns, this is a knife. I have to be careful. Does a child ever learn that lesson when they see pornography for the first time? No. Do you think they learn their lesson? No. They become addicted. That's why I say the phone that you put in your child's hand because the child is restless and it won't eat its food is sharper than a knife. The cut is so sharp that you can't even see the cut, but they're bleeding. And these children, they grow up. Then they start growing up. And once they've tasted it, it's very difficult to take it away from them. That's why it is imperative upon us adults to teach our children that it's all born within. Lust should no longer be a forbidden topic between parents and children. Explain to your child, Putra, you know what kama is? Let me explain to you. You know what sensuality is, Putra? Let me explain to you. You may not need to start talking about, you know, the fifth sense. You can start talking about other things. Because if the child is intelligent, they'll be able to apply it to every situation. It's like when I have a sermon with you. There are certain topics I can only go so far because of societal norms. As a Swaminathan said, there are certain things I have to draw a line. But if Swaminathan comes and asks me, I will explain to him the full detail. Because there are certain conversations I cannot have with you. Certainly not in a public discourse. If you're a female, then the boundary is much closer. There's really very little I can go. But that's why we have Anagarika Mahatmyas. So you can go and talk to them. I mean, I'm inviting these parents, dear parents, take your children before they turn 18. Go and sit them down with one of our Anagarika Mahatmyas and have them discuss the topic of lust. So that they understand what it is about. Before their 16th birthday, let them have that opportunity to understand what it is. That is all born within. It's not something that another person can give you if they understand that they're no longer going to need to watch pornography. But what happens is, after they get a taste of it, now it's like suckling on a mother's breast. Now to get their kicks, they have to sit in front of a computer. You know, some children are so addicted, ladies and gentlemen, they can't wait for 5 minutes until the bus arrives. The phone has to come out of their pockets and they're on their websites. Some have made that their homepage. It's like they switch on the computers just for that. They survive on it. It's like their lifeline. Because internally they have become so addicted to it that they can't, they don't know a life outside that. They don't wash, they don't eat. Right? They live like pretas. This is what is about to happen to them. You know, it is said, you always create your abode for your next life before you bring this life to an end. And you can see that with such people. When they get so addicted, when it completely consumes them, and some children we've seen, right, they don't wash themselves, they don't do anything, they don't do their household chores, nothing. They just lock themselves in their rooms, draw the curtains, everything dark, now all they need is their computer. They don't even feel hungry. Because hunger has no room to enter their minds because they're just constantly either engaging in such activities or resting because it's too exhausting. Some just keep draining themselves right from morning to evening, and that's all they do. Those days you used to hear these stories only about males, but nowadays even young girls. It's no different now. Technology is bringing everything to your living room, to their bedrooms. I mean, you have to do it because you love them. You want to give them a good education. But who's going to have the conversation? the conversation. I'm talking about the conversation. Who's going to have the conversation? Who's going to sit them down? Because it's not something you can probably talk about at the dinner table. Maybe you don't know how to make a start. Maybe you feel this is inappropriate for a mother to be talking to her son. Sometimes maybe you're dead scared. What if I start talking about these things and he starts feeling like that about me? Oh, it's not unheard of. You know, there's a separate category for that on the websites. That's what I'm saying. You know, you have to teach your children. Just as you have to learn for yourselves. If you are also victims of ignorance, then how can you help your child? If you see a certain part of a person's body and you feel, you have this sense of these emotions, then how can you teach your child? That's why if you can't do it, then bring them to the Mahasangha. So that we can help. Don't misunderstand this word help. It's not really like helping someone in the lurch. It's about educating. It's about imparting knowledge. I mean, this should be in the syllabus, is what I'm saying. It should be in the curriculum. Teaching Buddhism as a subject doesn't cut it. That talks about the history of the Bodhisattva, of how the Bodhisattva went on to become the Buddha and so on. That's good. You learn that, you go and sit an exam, you get a good grade. But don't you think all the people who do drugs, most of them, you know, they've also been through school. Most people who are addicted to these things, they've also been through school. They've also done religion. They've also done Buddhism. They've also learned Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism, all these subjects at school. And yet, it's not the history of religion that we need to concern ourselves about. We need to learn that, yes, but that is only just part of our education. What we really need to impart on our children and all ourselves as well is to really understand what these emotions are. Because otherwise, ladies and gentlemen, you can't handle the beast within you. Don't you dread waking up that demon? You know what that feels like, because you've been there. Now don't nod to any of these questions, okay? Because I don't want to give you away. That's not necessary. But I want you to answer these questions within yourselves privately. You know how desire burns you. You know how anger burns you from inside. You know how lust burns you from inside. Yes, you're all very respectable people. That I understand. But respect goes down the drain when lust surfaces. Because you are not a fixed person. You are what your thoughts are. So when anger comes to you, are you a respectable person from there, from that point on? No. I mean, that's one example. When anger strikes you, even you regret, you are remorseful, you resent the angry you, don't you? When you are reminded of some of the things you do and you say when you're angry, later on when you cool down, you hide your face in your hands and you tell yourself, God, how could I do something like that? I hate it when that happens to me. Meaning you're a victim. The same goes for lust, because all you are just minds and matter, that's all. No one's immune to it. Let's face the facts. Yes, you're all respectable people, educated people, you come from a good family background and all that is true. Yes, I understand that. But when a mind is attacked by lust, when a mind is attacked by anger, when a mind is attacked by desire, then you are hijacked. Once you are hijacked, that's it. Now you're helpless. Aren't your children respectable? If you are respectable, aren't your children respectable? Then why is it that they do things that they can never share with you? Why do they come up to us and they share with us their problems? Now, you're all very respectable people, right? Remember when you came to the monastery once and we had that program and you had a time to discuss one-on-one with Swaminarayanas and Anagarika Mahatmyas? I asked them, keep the names anonymous, but tell me what are some of the problems that people shared with you. You wouldn't even think that people among you have such problems. Who sit either side of you? But I'm not surprised, because you are your thought in that moment. That's it. What you think, you are. So when lust attacks, there's no respect at that time. When desire strikes, there's no respect at that time. It's just, that's what you are. It consumes you. You are what you think. When you're angry, you know that's what you are. If you feel jealousy, that's what you are. Sometimes you may not like the fact that someone you know, maybe a close friend, but these are some of the stories that go shared with us. There's a certain someone is does not like that their best friend, who they started off together at school, went to the same university, did the same degree, but now they're in a higher position than them at their workplace. And that always makes them go green. They don't like it. But you know that it's wrong, but when jealousy strikes, then you're helpless. That's what you are. You are your thoughts. These are just one or two examples. Because what you look like from the outside is not who you are inside. This is just an outer shell. You decorate it. But normally when you look at someone and say they're very respectable, you know, you look at the outer shell and you make that judgment. Right? Some of them maybe they're dressed up. Suited and booted. Right? Got a tie on or a black tie on. Right? Neatly groomed. Very smart. And you think, wow, very respectable gentleman. If only you knew what's going on inside their minds. Ladies, do you know how many times on a given day people who see you or people who you see rape you in their minds? But you look at them and go, wow, respectable man. Your mister? He's very respectable. Look at the car he just got out of. Ooh, very respectable. If only you knew what they're thinking, you'd turn around and run a mile. I'm not saying everyone's like that, but what I'm saying is, you are your thoughts. Let's accept the truth. Let's face the facts. They rape you in their minds. The only thing they can't do is do it physically, because that would be against the law. They'd get in trouble for that. But what they do in their minds, no one else knows. Do you know how many of them take mental images of you and they walk away with that? You forget them, but they don't forget you. Who's going to help them? In those cases, you are not the victims. They are the victims. Victims of ignorance. But what I'm saying is, don't judge someone by what they look, but what they wear, the car they get out of, or the house they live in. These are the wrong parameters to judge individuals. So what are the right ones? You can't judge, so don't. To be able to judge, you have to be able to look at their minds and see what their thoughts are. You have to be able to gauge their level of raga, dvesha and moha. Desire, aversion and delusion. These are the three parameters with which you can judge someone. But because you can't examine how much raga, dvesha and moha someone else has, you can't judge them, so let it be. So therefore, turn your lens back around on yourself and ask yourself, if you like to live a respectable life, ladies and gentlemen, this is the kind of respectable life I want you to live. Just because you're neatly groomed, looking very dapper, doesn't make you a respectable human being. Because up there, they know it all. Although your neighbor doesn't know what you're up to, he knows. You know, so he knows. Because whatever you think, what do you do? When you have a thought, what do? You put it up to vipaka, right? Every time you think something, if raga or dvesha or moha are present, then you throw it up. It becomes your karmic energy. See? So now they know. You can't keep it hidden. You're lucky that people can't see your karmic energy. They wouldn't associate you if they could. Most people wouldn't. They'd fear you, they'd dread you. I'm not suggesting that every person, every human being is vile and vicious and, you know, they are just a plague. That's not what I'm suggesting. But what I'm saying is, there's no such thing called a human being. All there is citta. That's what I'm saying. The mind is so flippant. It's so fickle. These cittas, they arise and pass away. Once desire strikes, it hijacks. Once desire hijacks the citta, there's no saying what's going to happen next. That's why it's so important to have these conversations. So whenever you experience a sense of lust, please remind yourself that it is not something that someone else has given you. So therefore, if you have a habit, if you know someone who has a habit, if your children have a habit of watching things for the sake of that, because they think that that's a sense of enjoyment, that's a sense of pleasure that they get from watching something, take some time to explain to them, my dear child, lust is not something that you can get from the screen. It's something that is born within because of ignorance. If they're ignorant, then teach them. That is the only remedy to ignorance, isn't it? What other remedy do you know to ignorance? Shoot them? Beat them? Curse them? Lock them down in the basement for a week? How about starving them? Punishing them? So if you catch your child red-handed, what should you do as a parent? Beat them? If you haven't yet, you will one day. One day you'll stumble upon their doings. That's why I urge you, if you can't have those conversations sensibly, then bring them to someone who can. If you feel far too embarrassed to talk to them about it, then bring them to someone who can. You know, when we are sometimes invited to go to schools and talk to children, we ask the children, dear children, do you suffer? Do you have these problems where you feel like there's a fire within you and you just don't know what to do about it. And you can't control yourself, you can't do your studies because you're too distracted. And then they walk up and say, yes, I have that problem. Now, let's have a chat. Then we sit down with them, you know, and what we do? We talk about lust. We don't say when you have lustful thoughts, go take a nap. We don't say that. We explain to them what lust is. Because lust can only survive where there is ignorance. Ignorance is darkness. These are all dark forces. The dark forces can only thrive in darkness. Therefore, the moment you shine some light on it, it is dispelled for good. That's why you need the light of wisdom. You need the light of wisdom, ladies and gentlemen. It must shine upon all of us. So whenever you become victims of such feelings, such emotions, I want you to remind yourself, this is only my ignorance. If you feel that holding hands with your partner makes you feel special somehow, if you feel excited about that, I'm not saying for one moment that when you leave here today you shouldn't hold hands. Hold hands, it's okay. That's a physical activity. What I'm talking about is how you feel about it emotionally. Because if your partner wishes to hold your hand, let them. Otherwise, they won't let you come back to these sermons. If your partner wishes to hug you, let them. If your spouse wishes to give you a kiss, let them. Let them. What I'm saying is, if you feel like you need that, you have a problem. If they need it, they have a problem. If you need it, you have a problem. And if you believe you have a problem, then you need a solution. I'm telling you that love is not something that is given to you by your partner. It's an emotion that you have because of a sense of inadequacy that you have, which is there's something that you want that you can't find for yourself, so therefore you expect it from the other person. And when they give it to you, you sense a feeling of relief. That sense of relief you experience as love. That's why when you have a checkbox, a series of checkboxes. We've talked about this in the past. How do you decide who to love? You think it's just magic? It's not magic. There is no such thing called magic. Everything is logical. When you don't see the logic, you think it's magic. So nothing in this world is magical because everything is hetupala, cause and effect. Where there is cause and effect, there is no room for magic. All there is logic. That is why the all-knowing one, the all-seeing one, comes and shares with all of us, expounds the logic behind everything. The principle of cause and effect, dependent origination, describes, explains, outlines how anything and everything originates. Love is no different. Love is not a magical emotion. It's based on causes. And what are those causes? Ask yourself what these causes are. When you have a bunch of things you expect from the other person, if they can tick as many of these as possible, now you begin to feel a sense of protection. You begin to sense a sense of reassurance that they're always there for you. They'll provide for you. They'll be there for you. They'll be your companion. Ask yourself why you need a companion. Because you don't want to be alone. There you go. Therefore, you can't manage to be alone. You can't bear to be alone. Because you can't bear to be alone, you need a companion. So whoever is willing to be your companion now gives you protection. That is your inadequacy fulfilled. In your relationships, all of your relationships are based on some kind of two-way agreement. If you wanted, you could write it down in a contract. Because actually, although you don't accept it, or although you don't see it, there is actually an unwritten contract between any two people in a relationship. Otherwise, why would people divorce? What leads one to divorce? When the contract? When the terms of the contract are not fulfilled, that leads a married couple to divorce. See, I'll tell you what one of the terms are. This is me. This is the other person. This is one of the terms. What? They must love me. This is one of the check boxes. Okay? This is you. This is your spouse. You must feel that they love you. I mean, you feel that. It's never something they ever gave you. You're the one who has to feel it, but somehow when you feel it, you feel like they have to give it to you. I mean, how unfair is that? Love is something that is born within. It's not something that someone else can give you. But when you are ignorant of what love is, you feel that the other person has to give it to you, and you make that one of the terms of the contract. How unreasonable can something be? Can anything be even more unreasonable than that? Once again, love is something you feel yourself. It is self-made. It is not something that someone else can give you. But you make one of the terms of the contract, you must love me. And here's what else you must do. Not love someone else. This? Oh no. So, what if you didn't know about this? What if you didn't know about what? This. Because remember, ladies and gentlemen, you won't be able to see it. Because is it something that is transferred? No. It's only born in their mind, right? So how are you going to know when your partner begins to love someone else? Will you be able to taste it in the air? Like you sometimes tell them, you're up to something. I smell something fishy. Is it in the air? You can smell it. No, because yet that's born within. Just as they once felt love towards you, if today they feel love towards another person, then how are you going to know about it? Here's the only thing that you can know. I don't know what you're doing, honestly. Here's the only thing that you can know, that they don't smile at them. They don't give flowers to them. They don't send chocolate boxes to them. They don't give them, they make phone calls to them. But all along, they love them. And you're okay with that. As long as they don't express their love physically, you're okay, right? Or are you? How would you know? I mean, if love was something that had to be transferred over some kind of medium, right, electronic medium or some kind of over the air, right, over the airwaves. If love was something like that, you could stand here and watch, right? Don't you? Don't. I'm going to watch you. Keep my eyes on you, right? You could do that. But love is not something that is transferred like that. It's only born within them. How can you tell when someone begins to love the other person? You can't. But all you can do is catch them in the act. Provided they carry on without, you know, secretively, behind your back, right, without revealing themselves to you, providing they continue to do that, you're none the wiser. And you're okay. And based on something like that, you put in there another term into your contract. Here's what you say. You must not love another person. Honestly, that's a very unfair term. Because love is not something that arises within you willingly. So how can you forbid someone from falling in love with someone else? You know, you were okay with them loving you at first sight, right? You loved that about them. They saw me and they were on their knees. It was a love at first sight. So love at first sight means they didn't ask you who your parents were. They didn't ask you whether you come from a good background. They didn't ask you about your educational qualifications. They didn't ask you whether you had HIV. They didn't ask you any of these questions. That love at first sight was what it was, and you loved that about that relationship. Right? So if that happened with you, can that not happen with another person? Because the ignorant heart is susceptible to falling in love. An ignorant mind is susceptible to falling in love. It's vulnerable to falling into dirty love. Just as much as they fell in love with you, they are bound to fall in love with someone else, provided they feel that some of their boxes can be ticked by another person. That's how relationships form. Here's what you want them to think. Even if they're attracted to someone else, I want them to think that they're already committed to me. Because they're already committed to me, they must respect that. They must respect me. Because you're so important, aren't you? They must respect whom? They must respect me. Therefore, if they are committed to me, they must not commit themselves to another person. I want someone who is entirely, 100% committed to me because I am so important. Tell me that's not selfish love. Is it not self-centered? Are you proud of that? Would you be proud to say that you want someone to love you and no one else? Having heard what you've heard today, and I've shown it to you logically and rationally, how this is all based in ignorance. Love is not something that someone can transfer to you. It is merely the satisfaction of fulfillment of certain inadequacies, a sense of satisfaction that you feel when your inadequacies are fulfilled. Right? When these boxes are ticked, they talk to me, they smile with me, they hold my hand, they wish me on my birthday, my mother likes her, right? They can get along. Oh, I mean, and then you obviously have the physical features as well. She's got dimples. Horses for courses. She's got freckles. She's short-haired. She's got long hair. She's auburn. So there are physical attributes which please you. After all, Meaning, this is what I like to see. As long as she has that, I love her. So those are the physical attributes. And then there's, of course, the behavioral attributes as well. When she sees me, she smiles at me. Again, something you expect from the other person. So this is entirely based on what satisfies you. How selfish? How selfish? Therefore, do you see how this emotion of love is merely these inadequacies, when they are fulfilled, you feel a sense of satisfaction. And you feel there's someone there in the world somewhere who's there to satisfy your inadequacies. So therefore, provided they do that, I feel a sense of love towards them. Which is why, when these requirements are not met, right? Normally it doesn't happen overnight. It happens over time. Over time, these things happen. Just think about this. Say, one fine day, you find them cheating on you. Right? Your spouse cheating on you. Let's say, one day, your phone, their phone, they've left their phone at home. There's an alert. You pick up the phone, and there's a message on there. Same time tonight. That's all it says. Same time tonight. From Alicia. And you're Patricia. Now you have to ask him, don't you? Don't you? You have to ask him now. Until then, you can't get a nice good night's sleep. I'll tell you what you'll be like when he comes home. Hey, honey, says he. Hey. Yeah, you've confirmed your worst nightmares. That you already planned the divorce. Right? You've rung the lawyers. You've already cried on the phone to your mother. As I found the text, you know, I'm sure it must be something. I knew it. He had a fling going on. Right? That's it. After all that I've done for him, how could he? So what's happened is really, one of these boxes that you ticked, and that box said, this must never happen. Shouldn't love be about freedom? I ask you, shouldn't be about freedom? What is it in reality? It's about locking down, right? It's more restrictive than COVID. I mean, you had no right to complain about COVID and lockdowns, because when you fell in love, and you promised yourself to a partner, they locked you down. Oh boy, did they lock you down or not? Now that was lockdown. You were used to that stuff. No more smiling. Right, no more text messages. You have to ask me before you talk to her. Right? You know the drill. What I'm saying is, folks, this is not freedom. It cannot be vimukti. It cannot be freedom. It cannot be liberating. There's something wrong with love, is what I'm asking you to think about. This kind of dirty love, there's something wrong about it. It's a human emotion. I get that. I understand that. What I'm asking you to do is, as an individual, just study what love is. Just study what love is. Study the theory of it. Study it in its practical terms. Because then you realize that this love is simply overrated. It's just an expression of selfishness. You are better than that, I think. I think you're better than that. Why do you stoop yourself such low, to such a low level? Why do you stoop yourself so low, excuse me, that you have to have someone to love you so that you feel good? Once you understand that this is all a creation of your own mind, these are simply inadequacies about yourself that someone somewhere has stepped forward to fulfill because they themselves have inadequacies which they believe you will fulfill. So therefore you have a relationship where I scratch your back, you scratch mine. There is a bigger love than that. There's a greater love than that, and that is noble love. With noble love, there is no such relationship that has to exist between two individuals because there are no individuals in that game. It's a completely different paradigm. There are no individuals. All there are minds. Two minds never fell in love with each other. In which case you have to fall in love with yourself because you are also a mind. So that doesn't happen. Only minds who believe they are beings, they fall in love with another mind who believes that they are a being. So therefore love is all based in ignorance. When a mind understands that I am just a mind, that this is just a mind, this is just a process, there is no room for dirty love. From there on, all there is noble love, which is basically goodness for all, happiness for all, wholesomeness for all, wellness for all. That's all. Compassion for all, kindness for all, generosity for all. Then it's for all. That's why your love, the love that you speak of, you can't give to all right now. Because that is all limited. Limited to what? Those who satisfy these boxes. These are the inadequacies that you have. Those who are willing to step forward and tick these boxes for you, those people, to those people you express your love. Those who cannot, they don't qualify. That's why you can't love your enemies. In fact, that's why you have enemies. If you do. If there are people in this world, in fact, simple as this. If you could separate all the people in this world into three different categories. One, the people that you love. Two, people that you don't love. In fact, the people that you don't like. And three, the people that you don't know about. So you're waiting to figure out which box you're going to put the third group into. That's what they are. It's a stranger on the street that you bump into. You don't know whether to love them or to hate them. Yet. But every time you encounter another person, you're always looking to put them into one of these two boxes. That's why when you're walking along the street, you look at someone, you smile at them. If they don't smile at you, what do you say? Even if you don't say it, don't you feel it? How miserable. How grumpy. I smile at them, they can't even smile back at me. Put them in the hate box. You don't know what they're going through. That is of no concern to you. Maybe they've just had facial surgery. For God knows. And the doctor has told them not to smile for like a week until their muscles heal or something. But no, if they didn't smile back, because you have a box. You have a box that needs sticking. What's that box say? If I smile, they have to smile back at me. And they didn't. So they go into the hate box. What if someone, the next person you see, they smile at you? Ah, they go into the love box. You don't know what they're thinking about you. They're the biggest con artists. You don't know. 2 minutes later, he's walking behind you. Now, don't you wish you never smiled at them? Isn't that why you tell your children, Pada, when you walk on the street, strangers, don't even look at them, don't talk to them. Right? If you see someone stalking you, right, 2 minutes later, they're still following you, give me a call. But that's because you are worried that your children might put them in the love box. That's because you separate your world into those, and there are lovers and the haters, and then those who are yet to be put into one of these two boxes. So eventually, everyone ends in one of these two boxes. They are yet to be decided. That's all. That is dirty love. All of this is because you sense yourself as an individual. You are a self, and therefore selves have selfish desires. That's why it's called self-ish. Right? So, selves have desires. So, selves have selfish desires. So, if selves have selfish desires, and these are those desires, those who tick these boxes, they get put into the love box. Those who don't get these boxes ticked, they get put into the hate box. And you're constantly evaluating people as you see them, as you meet them, as you greet them. Which box do I put them into? You can't even help it. These are your biases. You may have learned about natural biases and these things, at the workplace. I remember when I used to be at work, they used to give us courses. Every 6 months or so, they used to teach about natural biases. Be mindful, be vigilant that you may have some natural biases about you. Because if you are biased, then you probably tend to like some people better than others. Like people who you can better relate to. If you are of a certain ethnicity, they say, be careful, you'll be biased towards people of that ethnicity. Or maybe people of the other ethnicity. So they teach us to be mindful of these things. Because what they're saying is, you have a box. They don't know how to get you to throw the box away. So what they teach you is, remember you have a box, just be careful. Because you might treat someone based on your bias. And that's why people who are often victimized because of these biases, they always have to keep fighting for their rights. Why do you think women have a tough time at the workplace and so on? Why do they always have to keep fighting? Why are there always movements for equal rights and women's rights and so on? Because people have these biases. Why biases? Because they see selves. That's why. That's why you have a glass ceiling. You can't climb over the glass ceiling. It's a ceiling, but it's a glass ceiling. Because so it looks like there isn't one, but there is one. This is corporate speak. You know what I'm talking about. If you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. Ethnic biases, religion biases, language biases, complexion biases, gender biases, sexuality biases. That's why in certain forms they ask you, what is your gender? You can either go male, female, or do not wish to disclose. Why do they have that box? What if someone victimizes me? What if I'm vilified because of my gender? So therefore, I do not wish to disclose that. I wish to keep it personal. I wish to keep it private because my gender shouldn't be of anyone's concern. It should not affect or impact my job prospects. So therefore, I want to keep it private. All of this, this world is in a myriad of problems. It's a complete, what's the word? Kerfuffle. It's crazy. All because of this ignorance. I can't change the world, but I can change your world. I can at least influence your world. So what I want you to do, ladies and gentlemen, is when you have these emotions which are not fitting for a person of your caliber, don't let those emotions be an insult to your intelligence, to your wisdom. Lust will strike you. It will strike you tonight. I know it will. But when it does, do try and to spare a thought about what you learned today. Remind yourself that it is not something that someone else gives you. It's not something that someone else can offer to you. It is something that is born within. Therefore, there's not a single object or a person or an experience out there that can ignite these feelings or emotions within you. These are all self-made. You have a series of tick boxes. The more of them that get ticked, the more you feel these emotions within you. It's like being tickled, that's all. Isn't it? The only difference with the tickle is, you can't tickle yourself. But someone else can do it to you. Whereas here, no one can ignite lust within you, you have to do it to yourself. But in that way, it's like a tickle. It is born within. When someone tries to tickle you, it's not the tickle they give you, right? They touch you in a certain way and that you feel ticklish. They can't give you a tickle. It's not like they have lots of tickles and here's one. It doesn't work like that. A tickle is a feeling that you experience. But all they give you is a touch. Yeah, I mean, that's why you can't touch yourself in the same way and feel ticklish. So you understand that there's a psychological, mental thing going on there, right? In the same way, someone touches your hand, you have to know who's on the other end of that hand before you feel certain emotions. Can you see how senseless, meaningless it is? I'll ask you this question. Someone holds your hand, how do you feel? You have no answer yet because you have to ask me a question. Who is it? Why does it matter? Why does it matter? Because it all depends on what you think about that person. What you know about that person. If it's a stranger, then you'll feel a certain kind of emotion. If it's your mother, you'll feel a different kind of emotion. If it's your spouse, you'll feel a different kind of emotion. If it's your child, you'll feel a different kind of emotion. So it all depends on who's on the other end of that hand. If so, then that touch didn't give you anything other than a sense of touch, right? But then why do you feel that when you touch certain things, certain parts, like something special within you? Why do you have that funny feeling, that weird feeling? I'm just trying to prove to you time and time and time again that lust is simply a creation of the mind because the mind is ignorant. You could be touched by a hand that looks like a hand that belongs to someone of the opposite gender and those feelings will still arise. If you were to cover the person up completely, head to toe, but their hand was exposed, right, and you have it painted red fingernails, right, manicured, all that, right, and then they touch you. Now you have certain emotions within you. Then we take out the cover. And you realize it's an old man. Now what happened to that lust? Where did it go? It's like just like that, it's gone, right? How did that happen? So it was not what held you, it was those emotions that were going through in your mind. Because you only saw the hand, you thought this hand must belong to a woman, perhaps. And you had those emotions. But once it was revealed that it is not a woman, it was just a hand, now you don't feel that way. So therefore, please do understand that these emotions are emotions that are created in your own mind. It's in your own mind. There is not a single soul in this world who can give you love. You have to sense love from within yourselves. Therefore, why do you give people who you think give you love, why do you put them on a pedestal? Why is it on their behalf you hinder your progress to Nibbana? Why do you hold yourselves back from your salvation because of those who you feel are the people who are there to give you love because they never gave you love? What they need is also noble love, just as much as you do. That's why the sasana is about giving noble love to everyone, to one and all. They have their inadequacies, you have your inadequacies. It's what we shouldn't be doing is really creating an environment for the two of you to come and scratch each other's backs. What we really need is for each individual to be given the truth. Once they realize the truth, now they're out of ignorance. And they have realized it. Now they're free. Last question I'll ask you for today, before we conclude. What do you want for the person you love most in this world? For them to be happy? Do you all unanimously agree with that? The person you love the most in this world, what do you want them to be? Happy? Okay. Or do you only want them to be happy when you are with them? Do you only want them to be happy when you are with them? Or do you just want them to be happy unconditionally? Come on. Let's record that, please. So you want them to be happy unconditionally? Yes? With or without you? With or without your presence? Yes? Okay. What is the only way to achieve unconditional happiness? The Dhamma. Yes? Okay. So, need I spell it out to you? So if there's someone in this world who you love the most, what must you give them? The Dhamma. So that they can be happy with or without you. In other words, your presence is not a factor that determines their love or their happiness. This is dirty love. I have seen some people who are so selfish, right? They're so selfish, they shouldn't have been loved in the first place, is what I have to say. But it's too harsh, so I won't say it, although I've already said it. Some people who are so selfish that they don't want the surviving partner to be happy when they are gone. They don't want the surviving partner to be happy when they're gone. So when they're gone, just before they're gone, they'll make sure that the surviving partner will not have any means of getting into another relationship, falling in love with someone, right? Or getting married again. They will make sure that that doesn't happen. You call that love? That's how self-centered some people are. They are not to be hated. They are to be sympathized with. Because their inadequacy is so severe that it outlasts even their death. Even when they are dead, they still feel they will be inadequate. Even when they are dead, they want the surviving partner to not commit themselves to someone else. Because they still want to feel that even after I'm dead, it's like, you know, how people book their resting places and their coffins and they make sure that it's all velvety inside, right? Nice comfort. You know, I don't know why people don't air condition their coffins. I mean, I'm surprised really. Why people don't do that? They should really. And put a torch in there in case, you know, it gets too dark or something. People should really. That's how crazy people are. Even when they're dead, it matters to them what is done with their dead bodies. Once you are dead, what do you care where your body is rested? Let them throw it in the ocean. Let them throw it down into a pit. Let them flush it in the toilet. Why do you care? You have bigger fish to fry after that, don't you? If you are reborn, now your problem, what happened to your body from your previous birth? What happened? Did you know that dogs ate it? I asked. The dogs ate it. Does that hurt you? Then why does it matter what happens to your dead body? People care too little about their afterlife, and they care too much about what happens to their bodies once they're dead. If only people thought a little bit more about what happens to them when they're gone, to the mind after the last mind appears in this birth, to what happens to the mind, the next chitta, where it's going to be born, if people cared a little bit more about that and a little less about what happens to their body that they're going to leave behind, which is just a bundle of muscles and bones and all that stuff. It's just matter. People would live a happier life. They'd live a more sensible life. So don't you be like those people who care far too much about what happens to them when they're dead. To the body, it doesn't matter. Let them feed it to the dogs. If they want to do that, let them do that. Let them burn it if they want to burn it. Right? Let them bury it if they want to bury it. Let them give it to the butcher if they want it. Who cares? Why do we care? If they want to float it in the water and into the ocean, let them. Why do we care? Is the body yours? Then take it with you. If it's yours. You're only allowed to stay here because you're still paying rent. Did you know that? Stop paying your rent and see whether they'll keep you. What do I mean by that? Your rent that you pay? In installments, you pay morning rent. In the afternoon, you pay rent again. In the evening, you pay rent again. Right? Stop paying your rent for 3 days. See what they'll do? They kick you out. Go find another one. So this is not yours. You're just renting this place. Right? It's just a rental house, a rental home. Right? So take care of it as you would a rental property. When it breaks, fix it so that it's enough for you to carry on until the next day. You don't do up your rental homes, do you? Like you don't do complete renovations and build a new swimming pool in a rented property. You don't do that because you know you're going to have to leave it behind. It's not yours to take. So why do people not do that with rental properties, but this property that you have, which is also a rented property, you're going to have to leave this behind anyway. So why do people do so much to maintain this body when they know that this is only going to be there for such a short period of time? Keep it healthy so that you can live long enough to do what you have to do. Your purpose in this world is to attain Nibbana. Not to look good, to feel good. That's what you came into this world, to feel good, not to look good. To feel good, you have to be good. If you be good, then you can feel good. Looking good is just overrated. Don't fall for that. But people will tell you to be so. On the magazines, they'll tell you, on the magazine, they'll have glamorized images of people and they'll say, this is the target that you have to reach. Don't fall for those things. Pointless, meaningless. But while you're here, groom yourselves, keep yourselves neat, keep yourselves smart. That is important because it's all part of good manners. People, society expect it of us, so we have to be so. But besides that, don't shed a single thought on doing something that is fruitless. Because you came into this world to be something bigger, better than that. I want you all to make this your last human birth. So what do you think I want you to do after this? Go back to being a monkey? No, I want you to be your last human birth. And by that what I mean is, I want you to stop being born. So if this is your last human birth, then just remember that this is just here for as long as you need it. Use it and then throw it. Brush your teeth, don't forget to do that. Brush your hair, don't forget to do that. Wash yourselves, don't forget to do that. Cut your fingernails, right? You should all do all that. That is all part of yourself, part of being presentable to society. But besides that, yeah, if you're comfortable within yourselves, that's it. Don't let society tell you that you are not big enough, you're not slim enough, you're not slender enough, you're not tall enough, you're not plump enough, right? Your hair is not long enough. Don't let society call those shots, because they will tell you whatever ticks their boxes for them. Remember, there's an industry out there that makes money out of you thinking that you don't look good enough. Shall I say that again? There's an industry out there that makes money out of convincing you that you don't look good enough. The laugh's on you then, isn't it, if you fall for that? I have nothing against that. Because people are here, they need to make money. If they need to make money, they will do whatever they have to make money. Let them do that. But you need to be wiser than that. I'm not here to change the world. I'm only here to change the world for you. So don't let those people convince you that you don't look good enough, and therefore you start focusing on those things and start changing yourselves to look good for the people out there, because they can never be satisfied. What looks good today will not look good the next day, because the next day it will be some other kind of trend. You just can't satisfy them. We are here for a different purpose. We are here for something else. Now, do you remember what we discussed today? These are emotions that are born within your own mind. So here's what I want you to do. Last week I gave you a bit of homework to do. Right? As you do these things, thinking or sleeping, eating, remember I comes later. It's not I eat, I sleep, I drink. It's always sleeping, I eating, I drinking, I and so on. Right? If you practice that a little bit, you would have gotten a sense of what we were talking about. Today, here's what I want you to do for the course of next week. As you go through these emotions, when you get back home, you see your spouse, you see your children, you'll feel love. That's okay. When you do so, remind yourself that it is nothing that the other person has given you. Love is not something the other person gave you. It's a creation of your own mind. Like I said, lust will strike you tonight. When it does, remind yourself, it is only something that is born within. It is not something that anyone else, my partner, can give me. It's not something like that. When fear strikes you, let's say you're scared of the dark, or you're scared of spiders. If such a thing happens, when you sense fear, remind yourself that it is only a creation of my mind. It is not something a spider gave me. It is not something the darkness gave me. These things are not something that can be given from the outside world. They're all creations of the mind. Understand that. Then you are in control. This is how we work towards our own liberation. First of all, you have to feel empowered. I can do what I want to do with my own mind. Right? Others are not responsible for that. When you feel that you are responsible for your own happiness and you are responsible for your own suffering, now you realize that this job is something for you to achieve yourself. Once you have understood that, next you need the Dhamma. If you don't understand that, you will constantly keep pointing your finger at the outside world and say, this person is responsible for that, that person is responsible for that, my mother is responsible for this, my wife is responsible for this, she is the one who makes me angry, how can I attain Nibbana? Then without fixing you, we have to fix everyone else. Right, let's wrap up for today. When you head back home, people will expect you to show them your love. I must send you with that warning. Don't deprive them of that. It would be wrong of us to do that. Yes, your friends, your families, your relations, your neighbors, your colleagues, they will expect you to show them your affection. So if they come running to you and ask for a hug, please don't be the one who says, "No, Swamin Mahanse taught us today." Please don't do that. I tell you, they will not let you come back here. Right? Nibbana is a wholly personal affair. When you are out there, you have to be like them. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. When in Rajagiriya, do as the Rajagiriyas do. Out there, that's Rome. Okay? So this is only for your own understanding, your comprehension, and for your Nibbana. When you're out there, you're among society, people will want you to behave in a certain way, and you must behave in that way. That is not an option. Otherwise, please don't come back here. Remember, but you can contemplate on this. When your little one, your husband, your wife, your friends, they come up to you and look for a hug, they want an embrace, just contemplate on what's going on in their minds. Tell yourself, when I hug that person, when I hug him, when I hug her, he thinks I have given him love. Whereas actually, love is something that he's creating in his own mind, that he's experiencing, but he thinks I'm giving it to him. Just contemplate on that. That's it. Don't deprive them of that. Will you promise me? Thank you. Let's all take a moment to transfer all the merits that we have all acquired to all those who are deserving of it. First and foremost, let's take a moment to remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankful to us, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide this Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits and by the power of these merits, may they be free of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, and our teachers, and those who have taken every effort on our behalf, who've gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've still left no stone unturned to make our lives better. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakradeva, as well as all the Nimas gods and deities who have prayed and fulfilled the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our loved ones who passed away in our names, our forefathers and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. That has also transferred these merits to those who lost their lives from natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those who will have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them, and therefore, out of a sense of gratitude and a sense of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them, may we all transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become arahatan vahanse or an arahat teranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen nidatnva, dvesha ginnen nidatnva, moha ginnen nidatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sap labeva, nivan sap labeva, nivan sap labeva.
Tunurvange sosi ananta maha guna belen silu loka silu satyoma nibbana paramasukhen sukti taravetva. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.